Hi, and welcome to the Global Dog Activities podcast. First of all, a huge apologies. It's been a while since we've posted our last podcast. Lots of things have happened in between, and I hope we're going to catch up now and have quite a few people from around the world giving us their expertise on everything to do with dog and dog activities. Today, I'm joined by Viv Peel from the UK. And she's from Positive Mutts Training and Behaviour. And we're going to be discussing everything to do with separation anxiety. And we really hope that this helps a lot of owners, especially as we're coming out of, fingers crossed, the pandemic. So, Viv, over to you. Could you give us a bit more information about yourself, first of all, please?
Hi, Helen. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on this. Super excited to talk about separation anxiety and everything around that. I'm in the UK, in the damp northeast of the UK. I've set up a business called Positive Mutts about 3 years ago, and I'm a certified separation anxiety professional, trained under the amazing Julie Naismith, who I have a lot of time for with her approach and her ethics around how we manage these things. I also work with reactive dogs. And the reason I've sort of delved into separation anxiety and reactivity is because I was kindly blessed. I've taken on rescue dogs for a number of years, challenging. And then I was kindly blessed about 7 years ago with a rescue staffy who came with severe separation anxiety to the point he mutilated himself. And my husband and I were absolutely stuck as to what to do for the best. I found it very difficult to find the right approach to take, the right information. And so the journey began, and then it became a certified separation anxiety professional with Julie. So that's my general background and why I decided to go into the realms of separation anxiety of all things. It's one, I heard a phrase a few weeks ago on a podcast I was listening to. Someone described it as life paralyzing. And I think it's absolutely relatable. When you do have a dog with separation anxiety, it can feel like your life is on hold. And how do you move forwards? So I've got sort of firsthand experience and also hopefully the skills to help people move forwards and mitigate it and also address the problems around it.
Okay. It's very interesting that you inherited, however, you've got the dog, you gained a dog who already had it.
Yes.
So, which is interesting because I think a lot of owners think that they have done it themselves. They've done something wrong. It's all their fault. And even if they have taken on an older dog, i.e. not a puppy, even then they're probably thinking, I've done the whole setup wrong. You know, I obviously didn't introduce this dog properly to my household, my routines, my other dogs or something. But to actually inherit one puts you right in the middle of the mix, doesn't it? It doesn't, it's not even something you can warm up to.
Yeah.
You are right in it, right from day one, aren't you?
Yeah.
You suddenly realise, what is it? You can't go up the stairs and suddenly your dog's having problems.
Yeah.
I mean, to be given a dog and there it is, boom. There's the issue. So, okay.
That's it, certainly in at the deep end. And I'll certainly touch on a little bit more as we start going through as to, you know, why these things happen or why we think these things happen. And I probably will say quite a lot throughout this talk. It depends. It's complicated. And we probably don't really know the full answers, but we've got evidence around stuff. And we always look at back at the context of things that's going on. So I do always like the phrase, unfortunately, I know it can be a little frustrating for some people, but it depends. It really does depend on a whole host of things. There's no one answer and there's no one clear kind of, this is going to fix it. There's clear outlines we can do to fix things and help things improve and get better. So I'll go through all of this as we start going through. Okay, so what is it? I guess that's the big question, is it? What is separation anxiety? And we hear this term a lot, certainly over the last 18 months during lockdown. It became this big thing about my dog's going to have separation anxiety because it's not going out and we're not leaving it. First off, separation anxiety is quite a well-used term, and it is one that falls under the umbrella of separation-related problem behaviours. Okay. What do we mean by that? So under that umbrella term, there's things that come out of it. One of it can be separation anxiety, which is an anxiety, a fear, or a panic that's going on, be that the owner leaving or somebody is left and they can't cope with no one around. Sometimes they can cope, a dog can cope with the rest of the family members around or some kind of companionship. It doesn't have to be that significant owner, and other dogs have to have that significant owner. They get such strong ties to them. So again, it depends. The anxiety, is it generalized on the owner or is it they just need companionship? The other kind of questions that come out of that bigger umbrella piece is it really an anxiety? Is it a fear? Again, two different terms there. Fear relates to something that we know is going to be a threat or is a threat. And anxiety is about the anticipated, the unknown, the undefined threat. Do we know which one it is? No, we can't have that conversation with the dog, but we can make a general assumption, you know, it's an anxiety or it's a fear. We address it both the same in terms of how we move forwards. It might not necessarily be an anxiety or a fear. It could be frustration, fear of missing out on something, you know, and the frustration is about something being an irritant, some kind of unpleasant annoyance. A frustration could be a barrier. So it could be that a door is shut and then I'm going to get frustrated. It could be boredom. You know, have we done everything to meet our dog's needs? Is the dog doing something when we go because it's bored? You know, so people start to think, oh, it's separation anxiety. Well, is it? Is it? Have we done everything to rule out what we need to put in place to meet the needs of the dog? It could be an opportunistic behaviour. You know, so you go out and the dog goes, woohoo, party time, I can do this now. I can go counter surfing. I can start chewing the banisters or God knows what, because when you're around, you keep telling me, don't do that. So when you go, it's party time. I can do it because you're not there to tell me not to. Again, I always relate it back to a child. You know, you see a child scribbling on a wall, don't you? And you say, don't do that. So the child stops. And then you walk out the room and the child starts scribbling on the wall again. Okay, well, what could I have done? I could have given it a drawing book. So I always think, what else can we do to give the dog the behaviours that we want to be seeing? To not always sort of say, don't do that. Do this instead. Okay. And then the other kind of issues that come around under these separation related problem behaviours, it could be a confinement issue. You know, being put into a crate, being put into a small room, it can feel an anxiety, a fear, confined, a stress related to that, a frustration. So again, it could be that that's causing the issue as opposed to the owner leaving being the issue. Okay. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, especially that last one, because I think a lot of owners don't realise that when they take a puppy from the nest, from the whelping box, from their litters, the litter, the siblings, the mum, dad, mm-hmm. if he's around, some people have mum and other dogs. So then suddenly they're on their own. They haven't got their siblings. They've got no one to play with. Okay, yeah. Yes, you're there, but it's not the same as playing with another puppy. And I think we hope that we will replace what they've lost. And I think a lot of owners don't even consider that they've been taken away from their family.
Yeah.
And all those warm bodies and the snuffling and the breathing and the...
And the smells and the, yeah, the scary new world that they've entered into without anything that they've ever known before. Yeah. And it's like, bam, here we go. What am I here? What am I doing? Where is everyone?
Yeah. Especially when you say about closing the door in a room.
Yeah.
You suddenly think, what has that dog, that puppy or that dog got?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're walking out of the room, and yes, they probably will go, oh, it's a handy shoelace, or, you know, I'll jump on the bed I'm not supposed to be on, or I'll, you know, I'll go somewhere I'm not supposed to be going somewhere. And I think a lot of that's why they're replacing with something, you know, giving something.
Yeah. So again, it's kind of that big picture, isn't it, in terms of, you know, what's the whole context of everything? And so that's just a general kind of snapshot on separation related problem behaviors and what then falls out of it. So it's not always anxiety. The good news is, you know, that there's things we can do across all of those things to help our dogs learn to tolerate to being left alone. And it's the word tolerate is key for me. And I think for a lot of the separation professionals out there, tolerate is because, you know, we've spent thousands of years sort of breeding our dogs to be part of our lives, to be social creatures, to build up that relationship and that bond together. And then when we go, you know, it's perfectly normal that the dog would want to be with us. They're social creatures. We've established that relationship. Would a dog prefer to be with us? Yes, probably it would. Even one that doesn't have any issues about being left, it probably would prefer to tag along. They can be left at home and they can tolerate what's happening. And then you come back, you get a nice greeting and everything's good. But some dogs really can't tolerate that.
Going to ask you just for a break on for a moment. Mm. My neighbour started drumming, so you're going to need to do a cut.
No
on this
problem.
Okay.
So yeah, so they're more than likely want to be with us, but some dogs just can't tolerate being left. There was a paper in 2020 that suggested that between 14 and 55% of all dogs at some point in their life show separation-related problem behaviours. Okay. Wow. Again, go back to that bit about boredom, confinement, opportunistic, frustration. So yeah, it's not all about just the anxiety. Okay. So one of the big questions is, you know, why? Why does it happen? Why has my dog got this? It depends. It's complicated. We don't really know. But
I think we need a T-shirt that says something like "Dog training, it depends."
I would love that. I would love that.
Brilliant.
So in terms of, you know, we do know that it's the University of Helsinki, there's genetics, there's a predisposed genetic coming out of this. Fear is genetic. So there's a potential explanation. There's early life experience, the environment, you know, epigenetics all come into this. There's bad experiences that might happen. There's illnesses.
Epigenetics.
So epigenetics, it sits on top of genes, basically, in the Latin term. And it is about, you know, the experiences of the environment, things that are going on around us that will inform how our genes fire up. Okay. So if I were to look at, let's take my Staffy as the example. How old was he when I got him? He was 5 months old. He was a rescue. He was born in the kennels. He was, his mum was pregnant in there and obviously stressed. She was a highly stressed dog. So, you know, if we look at fear and stress and genetics, she's given birth to a litter of stressed pups. The environment that he's being brought into is stressful. She's attacked some of the pups in her stress, and they've been taken away from mum, who couldn't feed them and couldn't look after them. So we've got the whole kind of environment now coming into play. He's already got some stress hormones fired up in his system, the whole environment. He hasn't got his mum to sort of establish and learn from, and there's been a bad experience. So potentially we've got quite a few things going on there.
Is it possible for the bitch's stress hormones while she's carrying to actually go into the puppies while she's carrying them?
Yes. Wow. Absolutely. There were studies done on rats actually years ago, along the similar lines of that, you know, where there's a stress and a fear, and then the parents were subjected to certain experiments to raise the fear and stress, and then when the I don't know what you call baby rats, when the baby rats are born,
aren't they called pups or something? Pups, cubs? It is weird. It's not what you think it is. Yeah, go on. Yes, sorry.
Baby rats. So yeah, when they're born, they've never experienced that thing, that stress, that fear, that whatever it was the parents were exposed to. But when they have been, they've got that response straight away from the scent, from the smell. So, you know, there's something that's carried down along the line. That's informed this stress response, this genetic experience for them. It's quite interesting, everything that kind of comes into the mix. The other thing that can inform you know, what's going on is an illness. You know, it could be some medical pain, it could be some cognition issues of the dog. These all come into play, you know. It could be a change in life, change in circumstances, rehoming later in life, death of another dog, death of a family member. So all these things, again, we look at what's going on in the big picture. Environment is another one. You know, is there are noises, is the things the dog's fearful of? These can all come into play. So again, you know, and then it's sort of, you know, why does it happen? And I think you touched on it earlier that, well, it's you. It's you've made this happen. And as an owner, that's probably one of the worst things you hear, because you think, well, I've done everything I possibly can. How has this happened? Well, we've talked around all the other things that could be, but there's no actual evidence to show that it's your fault. You know, dogs are social creatures. They like being with us. Some develop more dependency on us than others. We might have hyper-attachment because of the way we've bred for childlike characteristics and behaviours. We might have reinforced some attention-seeking behaviours, but there's no clear evidence. We could, you know, if we look at dogs and the breeds, again, people say, well, this kind of breed is susceptible to separation anxiety. There's no hard evidence that a particular breed is. Again, if we look at all the common things that come forwards, what's the latest breed that's you know, the thing? We go through cycles. So we might see an increase of separation anxiety in, okay, let's say Mallees. Okay. Is that because we're now breeding more Mallees than ever? You know, and we go through these cycles. Is it because we've bred them because they are, you know, to be working dogs, companions with us? It can be same across all the board for all the breeds, really. So I don't ever single one breed out.
No, I think it's quite interesting, because you almost need to look also at the similarities of the particular owners that buy a particular breed. Because it's quite interesting, my daughter's got gun dogs, and it's interesting being around gun dog people, compared to people who have got pastoral or working, or compared to someone who's got terriers, or compared to someone that's got hounds. And there is definitely similarities in the people who have got these particular groups of dogs. So does that mean that we tend to go for those type of breeds because we like those traits, maybe because we can see something in them that's similar mm-hmm. to us? I don't know. But also, is it because, and I don't find many gun dogs have separation anxiety. Not saying that they don't, but I haven't met so many compared to other breeds, which I'd class as more Velcro dogs, more dogs that have real attachment to their owners. Again, I'm not saying gun dogs don't, but a lot of gun dogs you could literally give to another person and they would walk away with that person quite happily. A lot of pastoral working type of dogs, collies, etc., they wouldn't be happy leaving their owners. So there's a definition there as well. So are we buying into breeds because we want a particular trait, because that's how we like them to be with us? In which case we are just doubling up on again, aren't we? We're just breeding on from traits that we like because we wanted this trait. Gun dog owners will tell everybody, we want a dog that's great with people, great with other dogs. And if I need to hand the lead over to somebody so they can hold them, because I've got to go and do something with this bird or whatever, they want a dog that's really user friendly. Where if you talk to somebody who wanted a Malinois or a working dog or an agility dog or an obedience dog or a rally dog, they want a dog that is literally only looking at them. We want a dog that looks to us and asks us what do I need to do next? And, you know, I personally find that those breeds tend to have more issues with the owner leaving. Whether we class that as definitely the higher end of the separation anxiety, the ones that are going to eat their feet or something like that. But I have known dogs eat their way through a metal crate. They have literally ripped the metal crate out, and it hasn't necessarily been because they've been in the crate. It's because they couldn't access their owner, and their owner had walked off.
Their resource, their provider, who gives them everything, has gone.
So when you talk about breeds, it's very interesting is it because we have bought into that breed type, or have we created the breed type by us imprinting onto them what we want and breeding only from ones that we wanted these things?
It's really interesting question, and I don't have the answer to that. I really don't, and I don't know if there's any evidence out there to go that is the answer, because again, across the board, I think I've seen probably just about every breed of dog. I haven't seen a Mallee as yet with separation anxiety. Not saying there aren't out there, but I've not personally dealt with one of those. But yeah, for me, it's all those other things in terms of the context about what's happening. And the bottom line is that the owner should not blame themselves for the behavior that's coming out. There might be things that we may have sort of encouraged with sort of the attention seeking bits, but that's completely different from anxiety. So don't beat yourself up if you've got a dog with separation anxiety and someone's telling you to let the dog cry out, get on with it, pull yourself together, it's your fault. Just
what would you say were the top symptoms, if symptoms is the right word, if someone said, actually, I don't have a clue what you're talking about, because I don't know what you mean. What does it look like? Am I going to see?
Typically, because we've got to remember that every single dog is individual. Some dogs will show certain behaviours that others don't. Some are subtle and some are more sort of full on. Your common signs of separation anxiety are your barking, your whining, your crying, your howling, your chewing. your escaping attempts, which you've already touched on, your destruction, especially around sort of points of entry, like front doors, pacing, soiling, panting, drooling, hiding, shaking, big wide eyes, freezing and sweaty paws, spinning, not eating is another one. You also get some dogs that will, you know, a little bit less common but can happen is dogs that vomit, ones that self-mutilate, i.e. mine used to, and those that can display abnormal repetitive behaviours like spinning. Then you can get sort of the more the subtle signs, which is sort of the licking of the lips, the ears pinned back, the big wide eyes, the tail tucked under and yawning. And again, we've got to remember here, we need to look at context. So I've just said all these things, but as a standalone kind of, when my dog yawns, when I go out, it's got separation anxiety. Well, actually, it might be knackered. You might have just had it for a big long walk. So yeah, you've got to look at context of things. It's licking its lips constantly. Well, yeah, it's just had a drink of water or a bite to eat, or it's got a chew. We can't just say it's doing this. You've always got to look at the context behind it. And then some of the dogs.
I have to giggle a bit about the ears, actually, because Belgian Shepherd ears are like antenna.
Yes.
So they are not a lot of breeds that have got pointy up ears. They just stay there and they don't do an awful lot. They just stay up there. Malinois can drop them, pin them outwards. They can come forward. They can go like Labradors. They can turn one round and leave the other one facing forward. And it's incredible to watch, because when people talk about ears and if the ear gets pinned back, I mean, it used to be if the ears get pinned back, watch out, you can get bitten. And I go, that's a horse. That's a horse you're looking at. But obviously a lot of people say, oh, if the ears drop down, they're obviously worried, scared, frightened of something. But actually in Belgians, they'll do it almost, 1,000 times a day, I'm going to say. Yeah. 1,000 times a day. Their ears are literally on the go all the time. I'm very tempted sometimes literally just to freeze to a video of my dog's ears and just watch it. And I think that shows that some of the symptoms you'd have to take in context. I came home and my dog was spinning around and getting very excited, I wouldn't go, oh my god, have you been doing this for hours? But like you said, if you put the house camera on and you weren't there, and I can see my dog is just chasing his tail for hours on end, you know, or, you know, like you said, chewing the feet or pants, you know, just stressing,
panting.
And I wasn't there, then I would be thinking, yeah, that is a big issue. And I think sometimes you do have to take things in context. You have to look at what the dog is doing prior to the behavior and then during the behavior, and then say, right, you know, picking a ball up, you could say a dog is stressed because you pick the ball up and they go, oh my goodness, collies, you know, spinning around, and my Mallies will be jumping up and down because if a ball came out, they're like, oh my god, the ball's coming out, you know. But that's not the same. That is more of an anticipatory anxiety, I guess, if that is even the thing. That they just can't wait. So
Yeah, so as I say, it's look at the context and look at your individual dog. And one of the really good things to do is, you know, again, if we look at the context of things, you know, has your dog been walked and fed? Has it had chance to have a wee and a poo? Has it had some mental stimulation? Has all its needs been met before all you've gone out and done these things? Has it got an upset tummy? It might have had diarrhea because it's got an upset tummy, not because it's stressed. Is it opportunistic behavior? Like I've said before, you going out, it's like party time. I can do this now because they've gone. They're not telling me not to. So yeah, context is everything on this. So they're kind of some of the things around it. What I always say to people is one of the best things you can ever do is observe your dog. Okay, find out what's normal behavior and normal kind of body language for your dog. You've already mentioned your Mallies and their ears. That's normal. So if I was say to you, oh, well, your dog's got its ears pinned back, blah, 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 that's normal. So you already have established what is normal when it plays, what's normal when it's resting, what's normal when it's sniffing around and curious, what's normal when it's a little bit anxious. If you've got a document of that, then you know, okay, well, this is out of context. And that's always a good start to see what's my baseline that I'm working with. The next question is, can it be fixed? You know, my dog has got separation anxiety. I've gone through all these things. It has got it. What can I do? Can it be fixed? Yes and no, and it depends. Lovely, it depends. There are certainly things, there's a lot of things we can do to help a dog tolerate you going. I can now leave my dog. 7 years on, it was a long, long road from where he started. But yes, he can. Can I leave him for a significant amount of time? No, and I probably never will be able to. There's management and there's things I need to put in place for him. He's quite an exception, but he can tolerate being left now. Some dogs will always struggle. That is going to be a fact for them, but not all dogs. Some dogs will quite easily, with the right things put in place, go, yeah, I can tolerate these things now. Life is easier for me and I can be left. How long does it take? That's always the next question. How long can I get this fixed? Okay. It's that, how long is a piece of string? It depends. Yeah. For me, there's no, it will happen in X time. From what I've seen and what I've done and what I've seen with other people doing, 6 months, I would say, is a reasonable timeline to say you will see some good progress within that time frame. Is it fixed? I don't know. I cannot guarantee you that. And I think if anybody was ever to turn around to you and say, you know, my dog's got separation anxiety, can you fix it? And I say, yes, I can do that in 6 months. That would be a lie. it couldn't be something I could say.
I mean, there are so many variables, aren't there? I mean, how old is the dog? How long have you had it for? Are there any health issues? How many people in the household? I mean, if you've got a household of 10 people, you've got 10 people that all need to be doing exactly the same thing, you know, for the dog. Yep. How many other dogs or animals have you got in the household? What's your time scale like? What's your lifestyle like? I mean, there are so many variables that I think anyone asking anybody how long it's going to take. Who knows? And how deeply ingrained is it in the dog?
As well. And is it just one person? And you know, it's quite often you'll see a dog that is hyper attached to one person.
Actually, one of the questions we've got from Jacqueline, and she says, "Oh no, hang on, no, from Claire," and she says that she's got to the point where the dog can be downstairs. If she's up in her office, dog can be downstairs and now sleeps downstairs as well. Doesn't give two hoots if the husband goes out the door, but has got the problem if she leaves the house.
Obviously
you can't go case by case, but she has done it in stages. You can tell she's done it from the dog isn't now in my office, the dog is now happy to be downstairs and I'm upstairs. But I still need to get to that point where I can walk out the door. But again, in my head I immediately go, what's the layout of the house? So if I don't know how you would deal with it, but I'd be going, I need a little diagram of the house, because is the dog sleeping in the hallway right by the front door, and you've got to go out by the front door because you've got no other option? Or, you know, are there other rooms in the house, other exits, you know?
I'll definitely cover that one off. Okay, so how do we move forward on these things? So let's say we've got a dog with separation anxiety, like that instance. And like I said, we're not going to go into the diagnosis of it because it's all going to be a lot of variables in that. But you're going to start off, the very first thing I would recommend is you invest in that camera. If you've got a camera, we've got the technology these days. We're really fortunate with this thing. We've got Zoom, we've got cameras, we've got, you know, you can look at it on the phone. You can step out of that front door and you can see exactly what's going on. that's what we need. There's no point second guessing these things or trying to hear, right, my dog's crying and barking now. I'll wait a little bit and I'll see if it passes and then I'll come in. Forget that. Okay, that by that point, your dog is already gone over its threshold. Its threshold being what it can cope with. You know, if you've gone over what it can cope with, you've gone over its threshold. Okay, once you get to that point of your dog being in that state of anxiety and stress, learning goes out the window. The brain cannot do both. You cannot be in a stressed, anxious state and learn. So we need to make sure dog is under threshold in a way that it, you know, it can tolerate things and learn from good experiences. It's the drip feeding, it's the micro dosage approach that we need on this. The more kind of you build up of micro dosing good experiences, it's good experiences under the belt, so you can take the next step forwards. Gradual exposure. So let's talk about this one. She's gradually exposed the dog from being with her, and now it's downstairs away from her. Great. The next step is the husband can come and go as he pleases. Brilliant. But she can't. Her next step needs to be, you know, regardless of where the dog is. So we go back to this. Let's not confine the dog. There's evidence out there from what I've seen and what Julie Naismith's trainers and she's seen is that, you know, dogs seem to cope better with space. Forget the confinement. Okay, we talk different if we've got a dog that is destroying rooms, in which case we need to puppy proof or dog proof rooms to make things safe. But we shouldn't get to a point where we're leaving hit destruction, because if we're microdosing and building up those nice experiences, we shouldn't put that dog in that position of stress. We're going to stop before that happens. So camera, diary, always keep a record of your progress and what you've done. It is so easy to always look on the bad side of things in terms of, you know, I'm not getting anywhere. Well, actually, you might be. You might start to see the patterns forming of, if I train in the morning versus training in the afternoon, well, the morning's easier. Okay, we'll build on the morning then. Let's grab all those good opportunities to get the good experiences under your belt.
Yeah.
The afternoon sessions can trail behind and they can catch up, but well, let's work on what we can cope with and build those good things up. Establish what your dog can do now. So again, you get that baseline. Your absences, you need to suspend all your absences before you do these things. And that might sound sort of counterproductive. You know, don't go out shopping for half an hour because my dog's going to be under stress. Well, you've just spent the full week getting your dog up to 5 minutes. Great. And then you go out shopping for half an hour.
Yeah.
Bam. Yeah. Bad experience, fear sets in, you're not coming back, all that hard work gets unpicked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you need to borrow friends, family, daycare, sitters, whatever you can to try and share out some of those things. When we talk about sharing out as well, that's another good thing to touch on. You know, if the dog is hyper attached to me, you know, and I'm the one that provides the walks, the food, the cuddles, you know, everything is around me. I'm the resource provider. I'm the big focus in that dog's life. Well, you feed my dog. You take it for a walk and you start to sort of stretch that kind of sharing out, that responsibility, and all the resources don't necessarily now come from me. Somebody else is as important or becoming important in the dog's life.
Okay. That's quite an interesting bit though, because I think as the person who feels that they have to deal with the issue, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. realize that by dealing with it you need to share the load,
yeah,
is almost counterproductive in their mind, isn't it? Because it is. For them, especially if they think it is only me that dog has problems with, therefore it must be me that has to do all the work,
Y and Z,
to get the dog past it. But actually, by metering out those jobs, even if it is feeding every other day, or grooming, or mm-hmm. letting in and out of the mm-hmm. garden, or changing the water bowl, people don't realise just how much of a resource and memory set thing is, that a dog realises that, oh, somebody else gives me my water as well. It isn't just you. But I think for the person, it's really hard, isn't it, to say you need to allow other people to help the dog, to help you, to get them through
it. And it is about helping you as well, isn't it? Because, you know, it's stressful, and everything feels like a weight on your own shoulders. And if you've got that bit of support around you, it's going to help. It gives you that breathing space. And again, you know, when we come to that sort of self-care, we're sharing things out where we can. Online shopping, you know, that's there too. Yes. You know, all these things are there to try. You know, if you've got the ability to use it, give yourself that bit of breathing space. If you can, and your friends and family can mind your dog, and this is subject to your dog being happy to be minded by those people, because again, we don't want to give the dog to somebody where it's put in a stressful situation, but it might be your dog can go to friends and family. As long as it's got company, that's going to give you breathing space to get out for a walk, or just the shops, or a coffee, or anything like that, because it is so important that you've got that time yourself. In terms of getting out the door, okay, so let's go back to the husband and the wife there. The dog has got access to the house. The dog has got its bed somewhere. The dog can see you going out of the scary thing, the door, you're leaving. Okay, that is where the crux of the issue is. So for me, it's let's focus purely on working to desensitize those absences. Okay. Forget all the build up to it, all the pre-departure stuff, all the picking the keys up, putting the coats on. Yeah. Put that aside. Let's just focus on the big elephant in the room, which is you getting out that door. Okay. There's a good analogy. Where was it? It's not even an analogy. It's the wrong word. There's an explanation around how we backwards condition, basically. So when we look at desensitization and counter conditioning, what happens is that we have something nice like food, and that gets presented when there's a scary thing, so something nice, scary thing, something nice. What can happen is we present the food and something nice when the scary thing presents itself. So the scary thing equals nice stuff happening. You leaving, the scary thing's already happening. Okay. So then what happens is I'm going to go and leave and go out the front door. My dog already knows this is scary because I'm going out the front door, but I get a Kong and I put that down. So the scary thing's already happening, and then I'm putting the nice thing down. So it's backwards conditioning what's happening in that scenario. So if we forget all this kind of putting things down as we're going, we forget the picking the keys up, and we just focus on that front door, nothing else, nothing more. We start to build up, and it might be movement towards the front door and back, and you do that. Or it could be that the movement is too much going to the front door, and that sends the dog into an anxious state. So you might be stood at the front door and then working on the actual opening, shutting the door. And it's gradual kind of exposure of that side of it to then get up to the point where you can step out the front door and step back in again with the dog being under threshold. So like I say, you put all the kind of distractions and things aside, and you of the toys and the treats and all the pre-departure cues of picking the keys up and putting the coat on. Forget all of those for a certain amount of time and just focus on getting out of that door. There was a paper that mentioned, there was a paper that mentioned diagnosing separation related problem behaviors should present within 30 minutes of departure. And that was the Palestrini paper in 2010, and found that most dogs exhibited problem behaviors within 10 minutes of the owner departing.
Yeah, so
what, what you can often find and what you often hear is, well, I put a Kong down or I put a chew down and I can get out the house, my dog's fine for 10 minutes. It will be, because it's got something to distract it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that's gone, then the anxiety sets in, then the reality of that you've gone sets in. So like I say, put all that stuff aside for the moment and just focus on that front door and building up that tolerance up to the front door. If I go right back to the start of this talk, and I said dogs tolerate us coming and going, even the dogs that don't have an issue with being left would probably prefer to come with us. Most dogs will walk to the front door with you. Most dogs, even when you go and they're not showing any signs of panic or worry or anything like that, they might flop themselves by that front door and wait until you come back at the front door. That's fine, as long as there's no kind of anxiety signals, stress signals being displayed. So, you know, like what you said, if the dog is going to that front door and watching her go, that's fine. The dog is seeing her coming and going. It's the sneaking out of sight, and you sneaking out and leaving the dog. You can create a hypervigilant dog.
Mm.
So I like the dog to see me going. It's very clear as to what's happening and what's going on around that. The dog is learning that ability, that pattern of you go, but you come back, whilst I still feel calm and safe. Does that all sound sensible?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, again, all variables, isn't it? Because we've got a house full of dogs, and they're in. I've got one group that live quite happily, you know, as a entity.
Yeah.
Got a couple, as I said previously, that are managed, so they're behind a stair gate. And it's interesting because how you leave them, you know, I've got to go to work, I've got to leave them, I have got house cameras, I click in, I check to see what they're doing. 9 times out of 10, they're snoozing away to whatever's on the radio. And, you know, I will share some pictures later in the group with snapshots of pictures I've taken from my house camera. And most of them are literally almost hourly, and the dogs have hardly moved. You know, they're all snuggled up together. So they're all happy. But, it could easily have been a completely different story trying to leave dogs. So they're actually in three different sections of the house, three different rooms, because of the two that I need to manage. But they've got to the point now where they're not even worried about the group of four. I can take one away, and the other three are like, oh yeah, whatever, you've taken her out, that's okay, it's not a bother. But it didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen, you know, I had to lay down plans and ideas of how I was going to do everything. A lot of it was, for example, I might take one out and actually go to the garden. So I wasn't even going out the front door, I was just going to the garden. But when you've got this group of four and they're very used to being together, when you take one away, the others are like, where are they gone?
what am I missing out on?
Am I missing? And then literally within minutes, they've curled up on the bed, they've got bed, they've got water, they've got blankets, it's a nice room to be in, it's quite big, they've got the radio going, you know. So they just go in and snuggle up, and that's why. So sometimes it's not even about leaving. Obviously, you do need to leave the front door. You've got to go out that front door. Mm-hmm. But the lots of things before that are just a leaving the room, changing room into a different room, leaving the odd things like can you leave your dog in the house and can you go into the garden even though they can see you through a window?
Yes,
you know, or through a glass door. Can you do that? Can you leave the dog in the garden and can you go in the house and shut the door? And it's tiny steps, isn't it? It's not always about the front door.
It is that gradual.
We've done some things where some dogs we leave with Kongs and some dogs we don't, and I actually found with one of mine it was better never to leave him with anything, because when it finished he started howling. So for him it was like, thanks very much for that lovely treat, I've run out, can I have another one,
give me more.
So I'm talking to him on the camera and just go, you've had your sweetie, I will be back in a minute. But for him it was like, oh yeah, can I have another one please. I think if people I think definitely people have to give time.
Yes,
that's a biggie. Isn't it?
It is about that gradual exposure, that drip feeding, and that not pushing. For me, I always say, don't have this target in your mind, but by the end of the week we're going to get to half an hour, because it's not for you to determine what your dog can do. Your dog will tell you what it can do through its body language and its signals that it's given you. And like you've already touched on there, we've talked about the front door and building up that part of it, but you're absolutely right, there's lots of things you can do before you get to that point in terms of fidgeting. You know, you sit on the couch, you fidget around, your dog might, oh, I've got out, she's going somewhere. Well, actually I'm not, I've just moved and I fidgeted and I've sat myself back comfy again. So the dog starts to go, well, actually I don't have to be hyper vigilant, I can learn to calm and settle. Your flitting games come into this as well. So you walk into the kitchen, well, you might have this Velcro dog that has to come along with you. You get to the kitchen, you might stop in there for a little while, your dog settles. When your dog settles, you can flit to another room again. So these things are just sort of building up with the dog, that I might move and I might go somewhere, but I'm really done and boring and it doesn't involve you. If you want to tug along, that's fine.
Even down to the keys. So I'd recommend to people, if the keys are a trigger, to a dog that got a dog completely fast asleep, absolutely comfy as anything, and then the minute, like you said, the minute you stand up, they sort of like, oh my god, I'm ready. And the keys could be another trigger, can't they? And so I say to people, just go and pick them up, wrap them around the house and pop them back down on the table again, but then don't make eye contact with them, just move on, do something else, you know. The other thing you can do with the keys is you can rattle and then throw a treat, rattle and throw a treat, so the dogs actually stop thinking that the keys mean you're leaving the house, and the keys mean something completely different. It's because I think a lot of people don't realize how many silent cues that they're giving to their dogs that they're going to be leaving the house before they even left the house. So turning off the television, going to the toilet, shutting the curtains, turn the lights off or put on or off, whatever. You know, all these things you're
putting
doing.
The perfume on, brushing your hair. It's all that. I've had clients who were like, I've stopped putting perfume on because that perfume's now in the car. So again, it's all these things that come into play here. The flitting games, the fidgeting, playing games with your dog that reward it moving away from you. So you might play, sort of find it in the house, put some treats. The dog is moving away and being rewarded for moving away. You know, we're always focusing on recall and rewarding the dog for coming back. Well, let's actually give the dog the ability to be a dog and use its nose and do something in its own confident state and move away from you. It doesn't have to
learn to be comfortable almost in their own space. We talk about this a lot, about, you know, humans need to be comfortable in their own space. In their own bodies and things, but we don't really think of the same with a dog. We need the dog to be able to be comfortable. I mean, I love the fact now that I can quite happily walk through my kitchen, and that the older dog now just basically lifts his head up on his bed. Oh yeah, you're here. Put his head back down again. Now other people will go, oh, but my dog doesn't acknowledge me, or I want my dog to greet me all the time and things like that. I'm loving the fact that I can just go straight to the kitchen. He says hi by lifting his head up, put his head back down again. And he's not an old, he's only 11. I mean, for some breeds that's old, but for a Malinois, it's not old. It's kind of middle age. So he's still full of the light of joys of spring, but he's so settled in himself. And I love it. I can just walk through the room. He doesn't have separation anxiety. He just thoroughly is quite a happy being. But it's because I've taught him to be comfortable
in on his space. Own, yeah.
In his space. Yeah. You know, he has got everything he needs. Obviously, make sure that is most important thing first. But you do need to spend time teaching a dog it's okay to be on their own. At this particular moment, 10-week-old puppy is behind this wall in the room on her own. She's got everything she requires. And fingers crossed, we'll get to the end of the podcast.
Not a peep out of this. Yeah, but again, it's, you know, these things like the, we call it magic match, you might call it station training, you know, all these things are good. It's and when I teach magic mat, I teach it so I shape the dog to go by choice to its mat or its station, whatever you want to call it, and it's rewarded for that. So I shape that behavior rather than this luring or saying get in your crate kind of thing. It's rewarded for the choices it makes, that strengthens those behaviors. It's self-rewarding for them, it's calming, and these things build up over a period of time, so that you do these mat training or your station training, you can move away and you can come back into the room. Good girl, there's your treat. You know, you're building it up gradually the time you can leave. And again, do I want my dog to stay put on that mat or the station when I go out? No. I don't have any expectations to say, you stay there, I'm going out for 2 hours. That would be unrealistic and unfair to the dog, you know, but the dog now associates its station, its den, its open crate, because again, I'm talking open crates rather than confinement here, its den area to go into, to feel safe, to feel calm. And that's my point where I can, or it could be a sofa or it could be a bed. Again, one of the myths is, you know, it's your fault because you allowed the dog in the bed. Nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. Your dog is found somewhere comfy it likes to be. For my dog, with the separation anxiety case that he had, what worked was leaving the house open for him. And he went and slept on the bed. He could cope with that rather than being put into a room. He couldn't, he could not cope with being left in a puppy-proofed room. The whole house was open. Yes, he could. So that's it. It's interesting how you see the these things work around.
I do find it quite difficult reading sometimes. The states, they're not alone on this one. But quite often you'll see posts and they're talking about the dogs being in a kennel, and in my head I'm instantly thinking, you know, 6 foot high shed type of thing with a run that's about, you know, maybe 12 by six or something like that, like a kennel. And actually what they mean is a crate. It's quite shocking when they're talking about putting dogs into the smallest crate you could possibly get the dog into, and it will help with puppy training or loose house training, that sort of thing. And I just imagine myself confined in something that is basically blocking me. I can't, you know, if I'm lucky, I can stand up and turn around. If not, I'm the best I can do is lie down, and that's about it. And that's what they're on about. But you could imagine how that would create a dog who, we talk about, you know, is it separation anxiety or is it kind of a claustrophobia? Because they are so confined, they can't move. Maybe their joints are hurting. Maybe they just want to stretch out and they can't stretch out. So this goes back to, like, is it actually separation anxiety? Have you looked after your dog's well-being to start with? Do they really want to be in that? You know, do they want to be in that for 8 hours a day in a tiny little, you know, a tiny little crate?
Would they like to look out the window and things? And again, you know, some dogs like to look out the window. Some dogs looking out the window can trigger that kind of, you know, things happening outside, barking, anxiety, stress. Back to context, what can your dog cope with? It is kind of very much kind of, and again, you know, if you've got a dog that has separation anxiety, their resource has left the home, their owner has left the home, and it's in a crate, what's that going to then do? I'm more stressed, and because I'm confined, I can't get access to the thing that I really, really want the access to. So I'm going to get more anxious.
If you go into, if you go into their options of, you know, fight, flight, and fright. No, I've just missed that one. Freeze. They can't even do the flight, can they? Because if they are frightened, or if they just want to go and pace everything out, maybe they would feel better if they could just go and pace for 10 minutes and then they'd be fine. Like, I've paced, I've got rid of my stress now, you know. You know, we talk about things like go and walk it off and use a stress ball and, you know, go and do some kind of exercise to de-stress. And yet we expect a dog to stay in a gut. Now, at this point, I would say I do crate training and I believe in crate training. I think there are so many benefits from it if used correctly.
Yes.
You know, vets, I think some people think that when they take their dog to the vet, there's some lovely person sitting with their dog on their knee all day. But that dog is going to crate. Yeah, it would be lovely. I'd quite happy to have that job. I'd like that. But, you know, they don't. They go into a crate. If you travel them in a vehicle, 9 times out of 10, they're in a crate. If you need to take them abroad, they have to go into crates for some countries. They're not allowed to travel loose in the vehicle.
Yeah.
If you fly them, they have to go in a crate. If they have something like cruciate damage, you could end up with a dog who's in a crate for 6 months. So at this point, I don't want to say that we don't. I'm sure you're the same. There's absolutely good things. Yeah,
but they're good tools.
They've got to be part of a general dog's life. Yes. You know, they haven't got to be slammed in there when they're, you know, being told off, and they shouldn't be chucked in there when they've done something wrong. It needs to be like the crate I've got now. I can actually take the whole front crate door off. So she has got access, the puppy's got access to go straight into the crate. It's a very kennel, it's one you actually fly them out with. But the crate door comes off, which is brilliant because I don't have to worry about it pinging shut on her or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a den environment, isn't it?
It totally is. And I'm actually coming away from metal grid crates now. I'm coming away from those. Mm-hmm. I've had too many pups where they've caught their teeth and got them stuck.
Yeah.
So we go for like the completely, like they're not enclosed though. They've got some grids around the outside and obviously the front is open. So, okay. So let's have a quick look to see if there are any more questions.
One of the other things, sorry, I haven't sort of touched on, when we're talking around sort of separation and anxiety full on, do speak to your vet. Please do speak to your vet. Yes. You know, there's medications out there that really are available to help your dog. Mm. They provide that window of opportunity. I know I've been there. My dog was on meds. Did I want to put my dog on medication for separation anxiety? No, I didn't. I really didn't. I wanted to try everything possible that I could. However, it's better to do it sooner rather than later. It is that window of opportunity. It is that bringing down those stress levels to help the dog ultimately. It's, you know, And I was there myself, you know, it's going to change my dog's personality. It's going to make him zombified. Well, actually, the right level of dosage from your vet will make sure that that doesn't zombify your dog. Will it change the personality? Well, potentially, but it'll change it for the better because you've already got a stressed dog. Do you want your dog to have stressed personality?
No.
So that is one of the key things for me, it can be very challenging for some people to get the head around, and I absolutely get that. I really do.
While we're talking about that, definitely have a health check done first as well.
Yeah.
I mean, this should be the same for I'm so glad that I've been trained for many years now. But to try and get someone to take their dog to the vet before I went in has got easier over the last couple of years.
Yeah,
more people are accepting and more vets are open to it. Before, the vets would go, why have you brought the dog here? Because it's barking at people. Why have you brought it here? Now the vets are much more open about doing proper, thorough investigations to make sure that that dog is actually healthy, because you could be battling against absolutely anything, but if it's ill, then there is literally that has to be dealt with first.
Yep.
Because otherwise you're just banging your head against a brick wall, aren't you? There's no, you know, you're you're trying very hard to fix something and this animal could be ill.
Yeah.
So I definitely would say a vet check before anybody goes anything. In to yeah. do anything. So yeah. Yeah,
definitely.
And then yeah, medication if possible.
Yeah, yeah. Don't yeah, they yeah.
Don't so we've got a question. What's the other one? Is it a trigger? Is it a trigger source or an effect for another kind of anxiety? Does that make sense?
Is it a trigger source or an effect
for another kind of anxiety?
I guess we go back to, you know, that big umbrella of separation related problem behaviors. Is it a trigger? What else is happening? Is it anxiety? Well, we've ruled out it's potentially not. It could be fear of missing out. It could be boredom. It could be confinement. It could be environment triggering. You know, is everything been smashing and hunky-dory until next door fired up the lawnmower or, you know, the postman's been or the, you know, whatever. Sometimes those things then trigger. The dog's been asleep for 4 hours. It gets barky, something happens, and then it can't settle itself. Mm-hmm. Is that then it can't settle itself because that 4 hours is enough to be left? And now it's like, I really want you back. Or is it the fact that that 4 hours, you know, that it can't settle itself, it needs to go to the toilet, it's bored. Does that answer that question?
Yeah. I tell you what's also just reminding me on that as well. I went to a case once and the dog had been perfectly fine. There was no bother. They hadn't just got the dog. It was fine. But it was showing its signs of anxiety, the pacing, panting, stressing, all the usual things. And everybody was sort of scratching their head, couldn't work out what actually started it. It works out that they had a new neighbour move in and didn't like dogs. And their dog, I mean, dogs bark, sorry, that's what they do. They go out in the garden, they have a bit of a woofy. This dog wasn't overly noisy, but the neighbour had got themselves an anti-bark noise box.
Yes.
The one where it makes a high-pitched noise when another dog barks. And they were using it on the dog in the garden. And so the dog didn't want to go in the garden. They couldn't work out why it was defecating in the house. It was quite a difficult one because you then have to tackle the neighbour and say, you are using something on my animal without my permission and et cetera. But that
settling them and impacting on their behaviour. Yeah, yeah.
Quite an eye opener out of that one was, I have to say, because you go around expecting all your normal bits and pieces and then you find out that actually the neighbour has triggered it, to use a word.
Yeah. It's like being Columbo, isn't it, with all these things, with any dog behaviours, it really is.
I think if they'd only just got the dog, I think we would have then gone, okay, it's obviously something, it's turned up with the dog, but because they'd had the dog quite a while and it was a new behaviour. We then had to dig a bit deeper and find out what had happened and why it was happening. So I think that's it on the questions.
So we've covered off what do you do if your dog has separation anxiety. You know, you can put things in place to encourage flitting games, building up the tolerance to being left, raising its confidence about sniffing, moving around the home, finding games, your crate training, your station training, your mat training, proofing rooms if you need to proof rooms, using friends, family, day sitters, carers, you know, to help sort of stretch that sharing of responsibilities and resources out a little bit. Vets, we've talked around, we've talked about cameras, keeping diaries. One of the important things again is always remember, recognize that variability will always come into play here. You will never go this nice steady line of improvement up and up and up. You know, it's not life. It really just doesn't happen. So we should always remember we're going to expect not regression but variability because of all the different things that happen in the environment, postman, the next door neighbours, I'm not particularly feeling too good today, I didn't get enough exercise, you know, all these things come in. So you're going to get some up and downs. There will be good days, you will be bad days, but you work within the tolerance of your dog. One of the other things I haven't touched on, which I do kind of bring into play also, is that predictability. You know, dogs like some patterns to their life and that predictability around things. So when we do our safe departure training, you can bring in a predictor cue. Okay, so, you know, you're only going to go out the door for a second. And that's nice safe departure for it, if that's what the dog can cope with, you know. Then you go out, but as you're going out, you can say bye or won't be long or see you in a bit, whatever it is. That is a predictor cue for the dog. Okay. It's tipping them off that something's going to happen. And then you're coming back in. There were studies done on some animals and people about predictability cues. And the conclusion, I think it was in 2014, suggests that predictability reduces anxiety associated with higher aversive stimuli. So that predictor cue for the dog, knowing that you're going and coming back, comes into play. So you only start to build that up with those safe training departure cues. Don't do it when you're going to go out for, you know, you're going to push your dog over because you're defeating the whole object. But it's something to think about, just building in.
I think also going back to talking about using, I say using other people, that sounds awful, but, you know, friends, family, dog walkers, etc.
Yeah.
I think if you know that you have got something coming up, like, you know, birth, deaths, marriages, you know, if you have to go shopping for half an hour, that timing is crucial. So for me, I'd be saying, if you're going to get a dog walker in, you ask the dog walker to turn up 10 minutes before you're due to leave, they take the dog out the house, and then you leave the house. So actually the dog has left the house and has gone on a walk and doesn't even know you've gone. If they come back and you're not there, it's not quite the same thing, is it? So timing of having someone round as well. So you don't want your friend turning up literally a split second before you're about to leave the house, because suddenly you're giving, there's all that movement and excitement and turning up and coats being taken off and kettles being put on and things like that. And actually that is enough to then alert the dog, isn't it, that something else is going to happen. If your friend's going to come over, ask them to come over sort of half an hour before you're due to leave. So is that, would you agree with that as well?
I would, because again, you just, like you said, you're building in that, it's that pre-departure cue in a way, that then becomes the anticipation. Oh, a friend comes over. Oh, it's the scary thing.
You're going, yes.
Because you're going. You're now, my friend's now the scary thing, because it arrives when you go.
Yeah.
You know, you bugger off.
For the dog walkers, I always say to people, if you've got an issue, get the dog walker to come around and collect your dog before you're due to go. Let them go. Let them leave the house. Let them take the dog. Yeah. Let the dog have the fun of the person turning up and, you know, excitement of the new person turning up and going out for a walk. Let them go. And because there are times in life, aren't there, when you're trying to do this plan, you've got this idea of what you're going to be doing, and then something happens, you know, your office calls you in and you have to go in for some reason, or you have to go and visit someone in hospital, or you know, there are loads of things, but suddenly, even down to your car needing an MOT, you suddenly arrives, you've got to take it. Book a dog walker, tell them to come and take the dog if it's all safe and, you know, above board and everything. Things like that, I think it's definitely planning. I always feel for people who have got a dog like this, because it isn't like you can just, especially people that have rehomed a dog, you know, and they've rehomed a dog expecting all these lovely things to happen, and actually they are having to deal with an awful lot of things.
You're so restricted on your life.
It's
can be life debilitating at time and life paralyzing, but there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it really is about, you know, it's bloody hard work. There's absolutely no denying that.
But, and it's relentless.
Yeah, but
it's,
you can,
it's day in, day out, isn't it?
But you can really, you really, really can make a difference. And it is about the planning, it is about the drip feeding, it is about talking to your family, your friends, using the resources around you, speaking with the vets. You know, even the vets, sometimes they give situational medication out. So, you know, if things happen at the drop of a hat, then, you know, there's stuff there the vets can support you with. Yeah, it's a lot of planning and it's life changing. But it's also really rewarding.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I think the other thing I would be looking at is that the lady whose husband can walk in and out of the house without a problem. Mm-hmm. I'd be saying to her, you need to observe him. What is he doing? What's he doing that you're not doing? You know, is he, what's his pattern for walking out the door? And finding that out as well, because she might be, even if she can kick into a little bit of that, it would be helpful, wouldn't it? If she could just say, you know, oh, right, oh, that's what you do. I didn't realise that. I don't do that. You know, that can help, can't it? So
it can. And it depends.
It depends.
Because again, the dog just might have a thing for her. And that happens. It really does happen. Yeah. And sometimes the other partner can, I know it sounds silly, but I have come across it time and time again. The other partner can feel very put out that the dog doesn't do the same thing for them. Why doesn't the dog miss me when I go? It's just one of those things. The dog happens to have bonded sometimes more strongly with the other person. Sometimes that other person, it depends, is the only resource giver. So by sharing these things out and trying to stretch it out and make life a little bit easier across the board, then that can help.
But again, variables. So I've heard variables. People say, but I give the dog everything. I walk them, I feed them, I groom them, I give the do the training, I take them to classes. My husband, what partner, whoever walks through the door, and I might as well be invisible. You get the other flip, don't you? You almost get the other flip. And that is where you have to look at the dog in front of you. This is the other thing I've been saying a lot over the last few years, is you need to look at the dog in front of you, because the variables are there, the it depends are there, it's circumstances are there, you know, and obviously we've had a lovely discussion today and there are still so many variables on it, but I think the diaries are definite. Write a diary. Even I say people write a diary before you even start training. Do a few days of writing the diary out just so you can actually see what it was like before you even start. And then obviously start the training and put the and write the diary and see how things improve. But have you got anything else on your list that you need to
last one of the myths, because I know that this was touched on somewhere with one of the dogs, was about getting another dog. Or when you lose another dog, or when you're going out with another dog, you know, again depends. Get another dog if you want another dog. Don't get another dog thinking it's going to help your separation anxiety dog. Get it because you want it. There's a couple of kind of things that can backfire on that. The second dog can get anxious because it's learned from the other one. This is what happens. So they follow the patterns. You can end up, you know, it's just more to deal with. It doesn't always help your separation anxiety dog. Sometimes it can, without a doubt. Sometimes it can, but it isn't the answer, which is why I say get it if you want the other dog. It tends to follow better patterns if, you know, if I had a dog years and years ago, a big Mastiff. He was with my other Mastiff and she died. He was 9 years old and she was about the same age when she died, and he never ever had any problems at all until she died, and he went into separation anxiety. He weed, he pooed, he cried, he could not cope without her, and it's like losing a partner. If I brought another dog in, would that solve the issue for him? Potentially not. It might do, it might, because he might then have a companion again, but he was so heavily kind of bonded to her, that was his companion, that was his mate for life kind of thing. So, you know, it's that relationship. So I did eventually get another dog in, but only after a good period of time where he was then back to being him and confident in being his own dog, not reliant on another one. So yeah, that's one of the things, you know, people will say, get another dog or leave the dog to cry it out. Again, question is it ethical to leave your dog to cry it out and bark it out? Are you only raising the anxiety and the stress it's going through? Potentially, yes. Is there a risk that, you know, it's learning a behavior that by barking you return? Yeah, there is a risk that happens, but I would rather take that hit of a dog thinking it barks and me returning than take the hit that the dog's barking because it's stressed and fearful, because trying to overcome fear is a lot harder than unpicking a dog that has learned a behavior that by barking and you returning is coming home.
Did your dog see the other dog pass away?
He didn't. No.
Unfortunately, I've never had an opportunity. I'll tell a lie once, of allowing my other dogs to see one of my dogs who passed away, and I can't honestly tell you whether it made any difference or not. And I think, again, too many variables, too many, it depends. Well, I know other people who swear by it.
Yeah.
And if their dogs passed away at the vets, they'll either bring the dog, the body back, or they'll take their dogs over to the vet. This is all pre-COVID. And they swear by the fact that the dogs have been able to see the dog that's passed away, and therefore they understand.
Go for that grieving.
Elephants. Yeah, a bit like elephants. So yeah, it's always, but again, there's so many variables, you just don't know. We're in a situation where we've got quite a few dogs, and I don't know that they really know if one isn't there. Does that make sense?
Yes. So I lost one last year, and in all honesty, you know, one of them was quite close to her, but we put things in place and neither of them really batted an eyelid, to be honest. Yeah. You know,
One thing we do, which actually is interesting on the whole separation anxiety thing, when you're talking about dog on dog, because we had two Swedish Falhounds, and the dog was the older and the bitch was younger, only by a couple of years. And she was really bonded to him. I mean, wherever he went, she wanted to go. She showed not major anxiety, but you could see her go, oh, he's left the house, right? Mm. That type of thing. Not scratching the door or anything like that, but you could see, oh. And then when he came back, she was like straight up saying hello. And when, you know, when he passed, you could tell she was upset. Mm. She changed. She did change. And they've been together for about 12 years. And, you know, you could see that she was. And even though we had a whole bunch of other dogs as well at the time, we had 15 at one point. So, you know, these two were part of 15 other dogs. Mm. They were the only two Valens. And what was really interesting was that they just were like this wherever we are in the house. The two of them were always together. They shared the bed together. They went out in the garden together. More her than him, to be honest, more her than him. But there was a definite issue. She was always alert and aware that he'd gone out the house, if he was going to do a show or something like that, and she wasn't. And she did. She was sad when he left. When he left us, she was sad. Mm. And again, I think if she'd been on her own, I think she really would have probably stopped eating. I think that she would have done that. But because she was with a group of other dogs, I think it kept her going. Mm. But you could definitely see she lost her mojo when he went.
Sad, isn't it?
But she did see him when he passed. We made sure that she could see his body.
If you want another dog, get one, but don't expect it to be the cure by any means.
You could end up with two dogs with the same problem, couldn't you?
Yeah, double trouble. Yeah, that's all you need.
Yeah, both ripping us over to pieces, both ripping the door down. Yeah.
It's just is there anything else that we haven't touched on? I think There's another myth for you. Ignore the dog when you come in. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, the old ignore it. It's don't ignore it. You know, it's kind of, would you want to be ignored when you know, by your daughter when you walk through the door? You know,
No,
kind of like,
no.
what have I done wrong?
No.
Don't really know. No, don't feel very comfortable. It can result in frustration if we go back to frustration, kind of behaviors that come into this. If I walked through the door and ignored my staffie at that time, that would have been, he was a hugely frustrated dog as a behavior. That would have just compounded the stuff that was going on. So yeah, say hello to your dog. Don't make a big fanfare of it. Just a calm, natural, neutral greeting. Just acknowledge that they're there. Yeah, so that's kind of probably one of the last myths around these things.
I totally agree on that last one. I mean, Malinois, they're very boingy dogs. They're like kangaroos. They just jump up and down the air, get very excited. And if you and I learned quite quickly that if you just, I don't like the ignoring thing. Exactly the same thing you just said. And I haven't got a dog to ignore. Do you know what I mean? I haven't got a dog to come home and ignore, especially when they're showing such, happy signs. And I found that actually, if you just give them a very gentle stroke, they would then go, oh, fine, and off they go. And again, remember if we did have the, when we did have the multiple dogs, and I'd be like, got a stair gate, so I'd sort of kneel down and I'd fuss the ones low down as well. But the Belgians in particular, I just found that they diffused really quickly. The moment you just showed them some recognition, give them a nice sort of stroke on the head, their ears would go straight back. Don't like that, and they'd be like, "Oh!" Then they would calm down so much quicker. Where if you left them, they would just carry on jumping up and down. There was a bit of, obviously competition as to who could jump the tallest. So you'd have all of that, but they calmed down so much quicker that if you just go and acknowledge, and then they would just calm down. So I think there's a lot of myths about dogs that we maybe ought to come back onto another day. Just to do some myth busting on dogs and dog training. So,
Yes,
brilliant.
I could literally
Thank you very
talk
much.
all week about separation anxiety. So
Oh.
hopefully that's given you some and the people who are going to be listening to this some starting points and some things to think about.
If they want to get hold of you, how do they find you?
They will find me on Facebook under Positive Mutts, Training and Behaviour. They will also find me and other separation anxiety professionals of Julie Naismith's on Julie Naismith's sub-threshold page, web page. There are a number of us. But I think we all work remotely. The advantages of working remotely is that we can target people across, there's people in America, there's people in Australia, there's people in the UK, we're right across the board. But it also means that we are not influencing your dog when you come out to visits and homes. So people kind of like, when I normally say I work remotely, it's like, well, can you come round? I'm like, no, because it doesn't work to your favour. And doesn't work to the dog's favour. So, yeah, that's where you can find me. If people do want to do kind of just a bit of looking around, Julie Naismith does have a wider group that you can get onto. She's got books as well, and I keep popping her name in because she's the person I trained under. And she's got a book that's just come out in August, which is the Puppy Separation Anxiety book. So that is really focused on those with puppies.
Ah, brilliant,
Which is
brilliant.
great.
Well, thank you very much,
Thank
Viv.
you.
That's been absolutely amazing. This is going to be available on all the usual places for podcasts, but it's also going to be on the Facebook groups. So it's going to go on to the Global Dog Activities Podcast Facebook group. And it's also going to go into the Belgian Shepherd Dogs. Sorry, Belgian Shepherds training through play and reward. So you can find them on there. And please watch out for our next podcast, where hopefully we'll be talking to a lovely lady in Australia called Kay. But I will let you know more about that later on. So thank you very much, Viv. Thank you very much, and
Thank
take
you.
care.
And
Okay,
you. Thank
bye-bye.
you.